The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Towards a National Action Plan for HIV in Ireland is a conference that is taking place today and tomorrow here in Dublin. So how is HIV handled in Ireland currently, and what can we learn from other countries in terms of treatment and prevention? Well, I'm joined now by Rebecca Talon de Havilland, who is a trans woman and HIV positive advocate, Professor Jane Anderson, who is an AIDS specialist and consultant physician at Homerton Hospital in Hackney, and Stephen O'Hare, Executive Director HIV Ireland. You're all very welcome to the studio. And Professor Anderson, I'm going to come to you first. When I was preparing this brief last night, I suddenly thought, what exactly is HIV? I've been talking about it as a journalist for 20 years, but I don't think I fully understand what it is.
So HIV is a virus, and it's a virus you can pass on, and you can pass it on through sex and through blood. And it is the virus that messes up your immune system to the extent that if it's untreated, you get sick and you develop a condition called AIDS, which nowadays, because people get diagnosed in time and can take effective treatment, it's quite rare for us to see AIDS. But HIV is the virus that causes AIDS.
And you said there it is transmittable, but not always. I mean, full viral suppression is a possibility with the right treatment. That's been the massive development here.
Massive development. And we know that if you're living with HIV and you're on effective therapy or effective treatment, you can't pass it on. You absolutely can't pass it on. And that's a game changer. It's a game changer for people living with HIV, for their lives, and for the epidemic, because actually, if you can't pass it on, the epidemic will die out and we will see the end of this particular infection.
Have people been cured of it?
There have been a few cures. They're very complicated. There are, I think, three, maybe four people now who have had a cure. But it's a really, it's not a thing that is going to be coming online anytime soon as a mainstream approach. Yes, there are some cures. Yes, they're very interesting. Yes, they're showing us a path. They're not today's answer.
Okay, Rebecca, I have interviewed you on so many occasions over the years. And when I was reading my notes last night, I read that you were HIV positive and have been since 1987. And I thought, I never knew that, speaking to Rebecca. It's like it's not a part of your life, but clearly it is.
Yeah, it's actually interesting you say that, because I suppose I was diagnosed in the 80s when I was transitioning, and it was kind of compulsory to have an AIDS test. At this stage, I was living in London, because I was run out of here because I was transitioning. It was already, the Catholic Church didn't like the idea of what I was doing. So it was really hard to be that. But then when I was in London and I got the okays from all the surgeons that I was having my surgery, it was compulsory at that stage to have an AIDS test. Now, at this stage, I was living in Kensington, so I'm sure a lot of my Chelsea girlfriends weren't being asked to have a test either, you know. But I did it. I had the test. Now, back then, you probably would have had to wait a month for the results, or maybe more. Can't remember. It was a long time. But I remember going in for my test and feeling quite confident. I thought, well, there's no way I can catch HIV or AIDS, because it was just called AIDS back then. I can't catch that because I didn't fit the criteria. I wasn't into kind of like this crazy rough sex, I suppose, that gay people are supposed to have. Or I didn't come from darkest Africa, not just Africa, darkest Africa. And I come from Ranelagh, Dublin 6. This doesn't happen to people like us. So, I mean, when I was told that I did have it a month later, I was told quite coldly as well. You know, I was brought into a room. I knew there was something wrong, but I still didn't think it was HIV or AIDS. And they told me that I had it and that at most I had 2 years to live. And it was probably important to go back and tell my nearest and dearest, you know, at this
stage. So it was a complete life sentence when you got your diagnosis in 1987.
Absolutely. There was no even medication or anything at the time. Nothing.
And so what happened to bring you to where you are today at 2025, looking fit and well?
I don't know. Well, basically, I suppose I'm Irish. I'm stubborn. And when they told me I couldn't have my surgery, that I would never have it, and that I would probably have possibly had about 2 years to live, you know? And I eventually, anyway, managed to get my surgeries and all done by 1991. But now I had to pay extra for all of that to do it, because people were double gloving. And it's amazing how people were prepared to do it for extra money, but they weren't prepared to do it for not. But I didn't really care at that stage. I just wanted my surgery. And you also as well, which is quite interesting, I would have had all my surgeries done by 1991 when it was still illegal in Ireland to be gay until 1993, you know, but Ireland didn't accept. I couldn't understand it. There was a lot going on, you know, I was transitioning and then I had, and back then it was an AIDS diagnosis. So we didn't know anything about HIV. And I think the only way we can actually, for anyone to even have any idea how it feels like today is what people had to go through COVID. You know what I mean? Where people wouldn't touch you, people wouldn't look at you. You couldn't even get a hug from anyone. I'd get the same knife and fork if I went somewhere. You know, it was just like that for a long time.
People were so scared. People were so frightened. Yes. There was still such stigma. And in terms of the treatment that you are on, what are you taking now, Rebecca? And what is the prognosis?
Yeah, I take one tablet a day now. I'm undetectable. I can't pass it on to anybody. I'm probably healthier than anybody in the room. But I have been literally on... I often put myself down as probably was a bit of a lab rat, even though it's not a nice word, but that's how you feel. Because I was on a medication from AZT right up to 12, 14 tablets a day, up to one tablet a day. So, yeah.
Wow, so you've really lived through all of the different stages of what was an epidemic, from the time where they didn't know if there was any treatment to you having to take 14 tablets a day to now being down to one tablet a day and full suppression of the virus.
Yeah.
So does it impact you now, day to day? Is it something you think about or live with, or does it have any physical effects
on you? It did, and the worst thing was stigma and self-stigma, you know. And then, like, in the last kind of 2.5 years, nearly 3 years now, I started working with HIV Ireland, which was a huge help, you know. And I started really working at Terence Higgins Trust 9.5 years ago. Before that, I did not talk about this. I didn't want anybody to know. I was already a trans woman. And if people find out now I'm HIV, I could be burnt at the stake, you know what I mean? So now I own my HIV-ness, and I just, I live a very healthy life. I genuinely do, you know?
How many other people in Ireland are HIV positive, Stephen?
It's difficult to know the numbers. I mean, I suppose estimates have put it anywhere between 8,500 and over 10,000. What we see is... newly identified cases coming on stream every year. And we've seen in the past few years, especially since COVID, an increase in the number of newly notified cases. And a notified case is not just a first-time diagnosis, but somebody who has had a previous diagnosis but comes to the attention of the health services. So that's the figure. First-time diagnosis, you're probably talking about anywhere from 170 to 200 maybe a year. So it's not a huge number. And that is the difference between those two figures. Sometimes I think people see, oh, there's nearly 900 newly notified cases. It's very high. For first-time diagnosis, it's not that high.
Okay, so what are you putting the increase down to, though? Is that...
I suppose the differences in migration patterns, but after COVID, people coming back to work in Ireland, and so people who are already living with HIV and most likely on treatment for HIV and virally suppressed will be coming to work here, just as Irish people living with HIV will be going to work in other jurisdictions. So you do see the health services becoming aware of people linking in with the health services when they come here and receiving their treatment through the health services. But like that again, it's those 170, 180 cases of first-time diagnosis. That's the focus in terms of, you know, the ones that we're missing that we want to try and get to.
And what is it like to be one of those 170 or 180 people in Ireland in 2025 to get that diagnosis?
Well, I mean, I suppose when that happens, you know, it's a shock to anybody when they get a diagnosis like this, but there are supports in place. So the first thing I would say is that when people attend a service where they can get a rapid test or they get a HIV blood test, they go to a clinic, they go to the GP, they test at home, there are supports in place to catch those people and to ensure that they do have the virus when it's detected, so they'll be sent for confirmatory testing, and then to link them into care. And as Rebecca said, the care now is very different than the care that was before. So people can take medication as little as one tablet a day, they can suppress the virus in their system, and they cannot pass it on. And that's a message we're always trying to get out there.
Because there is some research, isn't there, that shows that nearly 40% of those new cases are late diagnosis, that people aren't coming forward early enough and getting that treatment early enough.
It's not just that they're not coming forward, it's that we're not finding them. So it's people who maybe don't know they're living with HIV, and so we need a mechanism to ensure that those cases where someone just isn't aware that they're HIV positive and there's nothing symptomatic to tell them that they're HIV positive, that we can find them. Because it's not until... As Professor Amazon pointed out, it starts to take effect in your system that people begin to go, oh, actually, I think there might be something here. I better go and get it checked out. Oh, my God, I've got HIV. So, you know, if we don't, we need systems and mechanisms in place. We have a lot of them, but we need more and better and more robust systems in place to catch and to identify those cases. The best way to do that is to test.
Okay, so that has to be worrying, I would imagine, Professor, because if there is late diagnosis in 40% of cases, then some damage has been done. Is that damage reversible?
Absolutely. Yes, it's reversible, but you're quite right. The longer you're living with an undiagnosed infection, the more chance it has to do you harm. Today's treatment, we know that people who start treatment as soon as they possibly can have a longer and better outcome clinically. However, starting treatment at any stage is worth it, and it's really, really important that people who are living with HIV know that they are living with HIV and are able to access treatment. One thing I think is really important, which we haven't talked about, and that is that a test not only tells people if they are living with HIV, but also tells them if they're not. And we now have very good mechanisms to prevent new infection. So for people who test negative, there are things now which enable them to remain negative. So
and this a is test a PREP, is, really is it?
So pre-exposure prophylaxis, condoms, all sorts of various interventions. But the knowledge of your HIV status, be it positive so you can get quickly into therapy or negative so you can take action to stay that way, is really important.
And that pre-exposure prophylaxis that you mentioned there, Jane, there is a bit of a difficulty, isn't there, Stephen, in accessing that there, in Ireland?
There is. We do have a national PrEP programme, and the government would be applauded. The government of the day to be applauded for bringing in a national PrEP programme. It is hugely oversubscribed. There are certain criteria you have to meet to get on PrEP through the programme. Gay men, somebody who's trans, somebody who perhaps is engaged in sex work, somebody who's having unprotected sex with somebody who is HIV positive. Those are the criteria to get PrEP. The problem is the waiting lists are so long through the PrEP clinics. At one point, they were maybe as much as 18 months. I don't think it's that much now, but it's certainly over 6 months, maybe 9 months in certain clinics. And that's far too long. Oftentimes, you're waiting for someone to fall out of the clinic before you can actually get PrEP. And that's just far too long for something that can be have huge preventative outcomes for you. We want to see anybody who wants PrEP, thinks they need PrEP, should be able to get PrEP.
Rebecca, Stephen there is talking about the delay sometimes in people coming forward and people getting tested, perhaps because they just simply aren't aware. Do you think also maybe people might be a little bit reluctant to kind of confront this because there is still a bit of a stigma out there, even in 2025, when it comes to HIV and should it develop into AIDS?
Yeah, you're right. And it's even just listening to you when we spoke before, like you'd known about HIV in it, but yet you didn't know, you know what I mean? So information is key. You know, we do rapid testing as well, as Professor said, you know. So basically as well, I always feel that when you're doing somebody like a rapid test, it's a 60-second thing. So in that 60 seconds, people have some idea what it's going to be like to be HIV positive, you know. And then when they get the negative, they change their whole lives, you know what I mean? But it gives them some insight to what it must be like to live with HIV. So I think that rapid testing is one of the ways forward, because also they can get tests to actually do at home in the privacy of their own home as well and send the information in, you know, because for me, I would definitely say if you're getting tested, you know, the most important thing is that you deal with it first, you know.
We were looking for a national strategy here that's part of the conference today. I'm wondering if somebody works in the UK, Jane, are the UK doing something differently that Ireland could learn from in terms of the treatment and the prevention of HIV?
Well, we have a national action plan and we're very proud of it, and it's made a big difference because it's brought the country together behind some shared objectives. It has really promoted testing. And we've actually got now some resource going into emergency department testing, which means that people who may be vulnerable can have testing within their reach. And it's been a huge success. But that has come from having a national strategic plan that's based on the data, that has got a cross-party, cross-government support, has actually got some funding associated with it, and is being monitored. So it is, people are being held to account for delivering on that plan. And it's working, and we're very proud of it.
Okay, look, we're going to have to leave that conversation there for now. But Stephen O'Hare, Professor Jane Anderson and Rebecca Tallon de Havilland, thank you all so much for joining me in studio today.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.